Welcome to What If, the Futures Legal Podcast.
I'm Hasti.
And I'm Rana.
Every episode, we ask a bold what if question and explore how law might evolve to meet the future.
From AI to space and everything in between, we explore how law, policy, and society adapt when the future arrives faster than we expect.
Because every what if brings us one step closer to the future of law.
Let's get started.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the second episode of What If, the Futures Legal Podcast. It's so great to have you all with us again. Today we're diving into a topic that feels incredibly relevant, not only because of what's going around the world right now, but also because of the future of justice and the fact that it might not actually look like this.
Exactly. We're exploring an area with much room for growth. Our topic today is what if justice focused less on punishment and more on memory? What if the real power of justice wasn't only in sentencing the guilty, but in preserving the stories, experiences, and truths of societies after conflict?
In so many parts of the world, from Ukraine to the Central African Republic, people are fighting not just for justice, but for their stories to be remembered. And today, we want to explore whether justice systems, especially international courts, should play a bigger role in protecting memory, not just prosecuting crimes.
And to help us think this through, we have a very special guest, someone I had the pleasure of meeting at an LSE UN Society trip to The Hague last year and was very excited to invite. Francisco is a public information coordinator at the ICC. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you so much and hello to everyone. It's been, I'm very delighted to be part of this podcast and this initiative that is really interesting, and I appreciate the engagement of students and also the alumni community in general of the LSE in trying to keep finding out answers to questions that are relevant to what's going on in the world. I am myself an LSE alum, and I'm also part of the International LSE Alumni Association. So I'm very engaged and committed to the university and school. I studied sociology at the LSE. I finished my MSc degree in sociology, and I specialized myself in the sociology of transitional justice, which is about, to simplify it a bit, the social and political collective processes that happen in a situation of post-conflict, so-called post-conflict, because that's also debatable, or a situation where or when a community is trying to rebuild its basis towards a peace-building horizon. So, that's why the name transitional justice, but that's where justice shows up as a key element in moving forward. So this was my dissertation. Even though I'm a sociologist, I use a lot of psychoanalysis for my dissertation because, and this is connected to the topic of this podcast, the reconstruction of history and the narrative and the way we understand our identities through trauma is something that is addressed by justice. And I've been experiencing this through my academic researches, but also in my work, because I did all my career in justice, not being a lawyer, being a sociologist. I worked for the Supreme Court of Argentina. I'm originally from Argentina. Then I worked for the illicit trafficking in cultural goods program of the culture sector of UNESCO, which had a law enforcement element and connected also to justice institutions and the protection of heritage and memory, actually, all over the world. And since 2019, I'm working for the International Criminal Court, Special Communications.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. Your experience is like incredible. You've just been around, you know, Argentina, UNESCO, and now ICC. So we're very happy to have you and very excited for the conversation.
So I'd like to start with our first question, which is, what if courts treated the preservation of collective memory through archives, education, and storytelling as equally important as sentencing? Could remembering itself become a form of justice?
Yes, this is a really interesting question because you mentioned sentencing and remembering. And one thing actually LSE taught me especially through the psychoanalytic lens I mentioned before that I used to study the Liberian post-conflict situation. This was in around 2013. I analyzed the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was created in Liberia during that period, I mean, a little bit before 2013. And something that I really learned through the research, the sociological research at the LSE, was that societies emerging from violence often struggle not only with what happened, but with how to remember what happened. And this is where justice plays an important role. In Liberia, actually, as I showed in my dissertation, the post-war establishment frequently promoted forward-looking narratives that bypassed traumatic elements of the past, such as slavery and some deep historical cleavages that shaped the civil war. However, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was actually these commissions have been practiced all over the world in transitional justice contexts, where they try to rebuild a collective truth after a conflict happens. We had it in Argentina as well. But in Liberia, they attempted to reinscribe those painful origins into national consciousness. When I say this, I don't know, just as a note, Liberia is a country that was created during the decolonization, but neo-colonization process of Africa, one can say, because it was a country that was populated by slaves that came back from the United States from different origins, tribes, ethnicities, and they populated, again, Liberia, creating a situation of slavery similar to the one they went through and enslaving natives who were living in that territory. So the country was created by, it's a very interesting historical case, was created by a private company from the United States to give back slaves to Africa. So the origin of the country is already very traumatic. The name Liberia means liberty. The national anthem of Liberia starts with "The Lobo of Freedom brought us here." This is the name of my dissertation, actually. So I analyze how this element of a constitutional or constituent, sorry, trauma open space for a lot of wounds and conflicts that led to the latest civil war that Liberia went through and all this national transition justice process. So the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Liberia, interestingly so, attempted to reinscribe those painful origins into national consciousness, but the establishment of Liberia decided that justice was not a way to move forward. I'm speaking about 2013, right? Mm-hmm. There were amnesty laws. There was not a justice process that took place in the country, similar to what happened in South Africa in a way. And this is precisely the tension that Freud describes between melancholia, which is the inability to mourn a constitutive loss, would be the exact term, or a constituent lack, or something that is lacking, or something that is traumatic. And mourning. Mourning should be a grieving instance, which requires confronting what loss and narrating it openly. That loss from the past or that trauma that we had from the past and narrating it. And I believe that justice is a tool for societies to move on. Yeah. So if courts understood memory as part of justice, they would be recognizing something sociologists of memory that there are many of them that I've been studying at the LSE and that I still study, like Hal Watts, Huysen, and Nora. They emphasize that justice is not only retrospective punishment, and actually I don't even like to use the word punishment because punishment shouldn't be part of the language of justice, confinement probably, but public narration. Yeah. Trials become something that some French sociologists call lieu de mémoire. There's sites where the past is spoken, disputed, archived, and made available for future generations.
I found that really interesting when you were talking about like Freud and melancholia, because right now I study law and anthropology, and Hasi studies law. In one of my anthropology modules, we recently read an ethnography that uses that same idea when looking at certain areas of the Middle East where there's just been continuous conflict and like no opportunity to process or accept loss. To me, like, this discussion alone really illustrates how the approach to transitional justice, for example, needs to be very interdisciplinary.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I am happy to say that institutions where I've been working, they value a lot the input of people that are not only lawyers working for justice. Like my case, I'm a political scientist and then a sociologist. And I think that this perspective was very useful for different mandates of the different courts or international organizations I've been working for, because the lens are different. The lawyer would probably, or the investigator would be more focused on gathering evidence and presenting accurate information to the judges to make a decision. But my role is to make those decisions understood by the public, because it's communications, and by that we reach some of the impacts of justice in terms of remembering the past and the deterrence effect of justice, reconciliation and stuff. So yeah, for the multi or an interdisciplinary approach for justice is fundamental, if that was your question.
Yeah, and I was actually just going to add something. As a Middle Eastern woman myself, I know my, you know, generational trauma that my family has gone through, any conflict that was going on around the Middle East, because, you know, anything in that area can affect you one way or another. And I was just thinking about the point of victims' voices. Do you think for some survivors, being heard might actually be more important and go, you know, a longer way than a sentence could do?
Yeah, this is actually a really good question. And at the ICC, we put victims at the center of the judicial process. This is the first time an international tribunal in its constitution, which is the Rome Statute, recognizes victims of a situation or of a case, depending on the judicial instance where we are speaking of, as parties and participants in the trial. So the ICC has a set of lawyers that represent the voices of the victims throughout the whole judicial process, and they're brought into the courtroom. Not the victims, the voices of the victims through their lawyers, that we call them the legal representatives of victims. And this is something very novel for international criminal justice that has been replicated by new tribunals or hybrid tribunals that were created after the ICC. And it's been used in the transitional justice process in Colombia as well. Some national systems recognize victims as parties or participants. Some others don't, because one may assume that victims can be represented by the prosecution, which is the person or the team of people that would accuse someone, presenting evidence to the judges. But sometimes, interestingly so, the voices of victims in the courtroom at the ICC, in the cases I've been following, because I've been in charge of the Central African Republic and Venezuela mainly in the last years. In the Central African Republic, we already have two trials going, where one is closed with a verdict. But during the whole trials, I've been able to identify a distinctive voice coming from the victims and represented by lawyers that was, of course, considered by the judges in the final decision. It's not only the prosecution and, of course, the defense teams that bring evidence, but also the lawyers of victims can bring witnesses, and they can bring a different perspective to the courtroom. So this is something that is really, really novel and an important part of the ICC and its working.
Thank you. That was really interesting. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about the use of archives before we move on to the second question?
Yes, thanks so much. It's not just archives. It's the mm-hmm. whole functioning of justice. Mm-hmm. For example, at the ICC, I see how real this is. My daily work, I see how justice is not just the outcome of a judgment. It is also the process of documenting atrocities, preserving testimonies, communicating with victims and the broader public, including the suspects' communities as well. And these are all tasks that my current role directly engages with at the ICC, because as I mentioned before, I'm in charge of communications. So one of the mandates of my role is to provide access to justice through access to accurate information about what's going on at the court. So at the ICC, we repeatedly emphasize that the court serves victims and future generations, not only through convictions, but through truth recording, transparency, and public proceedings. So these elements are examples of how justice acts as an element that can bring back or reconstruct or deconstruct also collective traumas and memories and to move on or forward. UNESCO's work also underscores the same insight, especially in a joint approach to an ICC case, actually. There was the Al-Mahdi case in Mali. The accused person, Mr. Al-Mahdi, was charged with the destruction of mausoleums in Timbuktu as a war crime. This was also the first jurisprudence of the International Criminal Court considering the destruction of heritage as a war crime. He was prosecuted as a war criminal, not because of the physical loss alone, but because cultural heritage serves as a repository of collective memory. And this has been reflected also in the decision of the judges. Heritage, cultural heritage buildings are anchored for identity in societies, dignity and continuity. And this is recognized, of course, by UNESCO, if you know the heritage program of UNESCO. But this was also underlined by the judicial process at the ICC. And then there were the symbolic reparations that were delivered jointly by UNESCO and the Trust Fund for Victims of the ICC to Mali. And they recognize that restoring memory is part of healing as well. So what basically happens, the ICC in its Rome Statute created an entity that's called the Trust Fund for Victims that is in charge of reparations when there's a conviction and assistance to victims throughout the judicial process when we have a case before the ICC. So in the case of Mali, through contributions from state parties and also private contributions, personal, private sector, etc., provided assistance for the reconstruction of the destroyed mausoleums in Timbuktu that were actually rebuilt by the local community with the help and assistance of UNESCO and the Trust Fund for Victims of the ICC. So that was an interesting anecdote to tell how I was working for UNESCO back then, and then I ended up working for the ICC, but how those two institutions integrated memory as part of healing after conflict. So if we move back a little bit to Argentina, where I worked at the Supreme Court in international affairs, the chambers of the Chief Justice, there was a decision while I was working there, well, several decisions that happened between 2005, 2018, that they show something similar post-dictatorship in Argentina. So the Supreme Court struck down the amnesty laws between 2005 and 2008. These amnesty laws were from the 90s. And they were declared unconstitutional and at the same time against international public law. Because Argentina had signed a lot of international human rights treaties or international treaties that were saying that crimes against humanity would not prescribe. So amnesty wouldn't be possible. So this decision from the court reopened all prosecutions that were stopped in the 90s for crimes allegedly committed in the 70s. That was a huge wound in Argentine society. So it reopened the national narrative. Just as a session with your psychologist, basically. This is where I draw the parallelism between justice and psychology, especially mm-hmm. psychoanalysis. Only then could the country confront the structural causes of the atrocities, reconstruct its own story, and in a sense, hopefully, undergo a collective analysis of what happened in the past. So this was also a process that made Argentina rethink of what happened in the 70s, something that had been silenced by the amnesty laws. So yes, remembering can itself be a form of justice. When courts enshrine memory, they help societies transition from melancholia to mourning to grieving. They create the conditions for truth to become a shared foundation rather than a contested wound.
This brings us to our boldest what-if question. What if the world's measure of justice was not how many people were convicted, but how deeply societies remembered what happened? Could that redefine the ICC's legacy from punishing crimes to shaping collective memory?
Okay, thank you so much for this question, which resonates profoundly with the findings of my dissertation, first and foremost, because transition and justice, and this is one of the conclusions of my dissertation, is often imagined as linear, You've got truth, then reconciliation, then justice. But in practice, it is a struggle over memory. And this is what I'm arguing in my dissertation or my research, my sociological research. In transitional justice processes, we are debating who gets to define the past, which silences remain, which stories become national truth and stuff. And while this national truth is being reconstructed, this is where justice plays a key role. As I mentioned before, in the courtroom, the whole history of a trauma can be reconstructed hopefully for the betterment of societies. So, yes, one part of the question was about the quantity of convictions. The ICC is frequently evaluated numerically. We have key performance indicators. We speak to our state parties about things that we can measure, like number of investigations, arrests, convictions, etc. Since the operationalization of the court in 2002, the judges have issued 11 convictions and 4 acquittals. However, this number doesn't say so much in terms of the substance of the question, because we can measure number of investigations, arrests, convictions, etc. But even we acknowledge, and we know, myself, by working also in the field, speaking to communities affected by the crimes being investigated and being part of a judicial process at the court, that justice impact cannot be measured by statistics alone. Its mandate includes documenting crimes, recognizing victims, setting global norms, and affirming the international community's refusal to forget. And this is very nice and important, and it resonates with one of the actually mottos that came out of the first trials for crimes against humanity that happened in Argentina in 1985, and the report from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Argentina that was called Nunca Más, that in Spanish means never again, or in French we use it at the ICC as Plus Jamais Ça. This is the refusal to forget, because never again means this will not happen again. And that's where we have the deterrence effect of justice as well. When you are reconstructing what happened in your head and going through the root causes of a collective trauma, probably you will think twice the next time when you identify those social symptoms again in your social structure. So if we evaluate it, the court's legacy instead through the depth of remembrance it enables, but not only the ICC, I'm speaking about justice in general. Several things are important. I will mention 4 elements. The first one is that justice could be memory making institutions, or justice could open the space for memory making institutions, public trials, detailed judgments, explained detailed judgments to people in the communities, victims' participation, reparations orders, assistance to victims, all contribute to the historical record, because all this is recorded definitely. In the case that I mentioned in Mali, the Al-Mahdi case, the court explicitly recognized the symbolic value of heritage and memory, for example. So this is also recorded in the jurisprudence and a decision of the court. So written on a stone, we could say as well. And this is jurisprudence as archival practice. The second element I wanted to mention is that justice already shapes narratives for future generations. In my daily work as public information coordinator, I see how communities rely on the ICC documentation to understand what happened. And also they rely upon our role as outreach officers or public information officers to explain what happened in the courtroom, which actually also explains what may have happened in the country. And communication becomes part of justice, ensuring that all the challenges that we face as an institution, not only in the ICC, all justice institutions, do not obscure the voices of victims, which is, again, a very important central part of the narrative of justice in the courtroom. Third element is that memory creates deterrence through truth. I mentioned this before, but I would like to elaborate a bit more. Argentina illustrates this beautifully, actually. The act of remembering, the public trials, testimonies, archives, transforms society in Argentina. I recommend you to watch, there's a film that's called Argentina 1985. I was born 1984, so it's a very symbolic date for me as well. I was born right after democracy came back to Argentina in 1983. So I was born 1 year after and 1 year before the first trial for crimes against humanity happened in Argentina. And this is where you can also see the role of the first prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Luis Moreno Ocampo, that was the prosecutor in this trial, in this first trial, actually, that happened in Argentina. So what happened? Justice became part of the national identity of Argentina in the 80s. It created a shared moral vocabulary that made a return to dictatorship hopefully unthinkable, even though we're facing some challenges nowadays in terms of institutions in Argentina. But the sole thought of going back to what happened in the 70s, I would like to think is unthinkable after all this justice process that took place in Argentina in the 2000s and the first trial in the 80s. And the fourth element, finally, is that memory can heal the melancholia at the heart of post-conflict societies. As I argued in my dissertation following Freud, Judith Butler, Franz Fanon, Achille Bembé, many authors that you may have read or that you may want to read that I recommend, one of my favorites actually, because they talk a lot about neocolonialism as well and relationship with human rights and justice. So what they claim in general, and I found a common pattern between Freud, Judith Butler, Fanon, Bembé, and even Lacan, is that conflicts rooted in founding traumas require memory work to move from unprocessed melancholia to mourning or grieving. And this is where justice operates. This is my thesis. Courts can assist in this by recognizing the lost object or the traumatic object, which means lives, cultures, buildings, sovereignties, and giving it symbolic form in law, as I said before. A decision is a recognition. A decision from the judges, right? So yes, if the measure of justice shifted from conviction rates to the depth of societal remembrance, the ICC's legacy might become more transformative. Not only the ICC, but justice legacy in general, every time there's a conflict that that has in itself atrocities or human rights violations. It would be seen not only as a court of law, any court, but beyond being a court of law, a custodian of memory. Like justice institutions as being custodians of memories or reconstructors of memories as well. A space where humanity records its darkest hours in order to prevent their return. And this is something that happens also in when we analyze ourselves in our lives at the macro level, as a societal level. And for me personally, drawing together my work at UNESCO, my time at my beautiful time at the LSE, and my role at the ICC nowadays, that is the most meaningful part of justice. Not speaking about punishment. Convictions and acquittals, of course, are important because that's the definition that judges will find in terms of individual responsibility after crimes that were allegedly committed in a period of time in a certain area. But what's the most important element for me and what makes me feel so proud to have been working for justice all my career is that it ensures that the stories of victims, survivors, and even perpetrators or accused persons become part of a collective memory that enables new, more peaceful forms of coexistence, hopefully. And this relates directly to the Hannah Arendt's concept of forgiveness. There is a new beginning, the possibility of a new start or a rebirth after a conflict happens or after some paradigm is debated in a society and is creating conflict. So yeah, this were the four elements that I identified answering your last question.
Amazing. I think this was like emotional, but also so knowledgeable. Like, it's fascinating. It's been a great discussion, Francisco, and sadly we have to bring it to an end. I think the biggest takeaway for me is that justice isn't only about courtroom. It's about how people remember what happened and whether the survivors have their voices heard.
Yes. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences. I think what's going to stick with me the most is truth as deterrence. That's something I'd never thought of. Also, so many of your favorite writers, also people that I've read, but I've thought of them separately, as like Judith Butler for gender, Membembe as like necropolitics. Like, I'd never connected memory and trauma as like a common theme across them. So thank you for these insights.
And something that I would like to underline in the end is not only deterrence, but also reconciliation. That there's a reconciliatory element, because every time that the narrative is being reconstructed, also the so-called perpetrators or the potential perpetrators and the victims, they, in the end, through a decision and through, it's not a debate, but through a reconstruction of a narrative in the courtroom, there is a conclusion, and this conclusion is a decision from the judges that can set a new beginning, and as I said before, in terms of Hannah Arendt.
Amazing. And so to anyone listening, thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed this conversation, follow us for more episode exploring the future of law, and send us your own what if questions, and maybe we could explore them at Instagram, whatif_podcast.
See you next time. Thank you so much.